You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 14, today we're in Mende.
Now, happily, I can start today's pod with a little bit of good COVID news, which doesn't happen very often, and that is that Lionel Burney has returned a couple of negative COVID tests, so he is whizzing his way out to you guys in France. I think by the time that this pod will go out, he will actually be landing in Toulouse, so hopefully he'll be there, but he's going to miss out on what I can see now is probably the most picturesque setting that you two have been in. So, you know, tell us now, where are we, François?
We're in a nice place, actually, called the Domaine de Carrière, and it's in Marvejols. Marvejols is a little village in Lozère. As I said to you before we started, when I was a young guy and I was on my running days, I used to do this half marathon from Marvejols to Mende. So I guess, you know, Marvejols to Mende must be around 21K. That sounds plausible. But it's a very nice place. We're in a little patio, waiting for dinner, drinking a local beer, craft beer called Lupuline, it's quite good actually. Kind of lager with flavor, so everything's fine. And as for Lionel, I already booked the cassoulet for Sunday in Carcassonne, because obviously to celebrate the return of napalm and probably England's, or at least Britain's.
Islands, really, François.
Islands, yeah.
Before you say
islands,
anything more.
Whichever nationality is, but the British Isles are, in a general sense, probably number one cassoulet fan. So he'll have a treat for his return tomorrow in Carcassonne.
Oh, wonderful. Boz, do you like cassoulet? I hope so.
No, but once I saw that I was going to be here for this week and that we were going to Carcassonne, I told Francois that was one of the things I would love to request on this trip was a cassoulet, because I've actually never had it. I've heard of Lionel talk about it immensely, and I've heard him, a podcast where he actually made it himself, but I've never actually had it. So I'm really looking forward to actually getting down to Carcassonne tomorrow and having one final supper here in France.
And obviously having cassoulet with Lionel is like sitting down with a master, isn't it? That's getting the full experience.
Absolutely. He'll explain everything to you, the beans. And do you like beans? That's the first question.
I eat a lot of beans, yes.
Yeah, so if you eat a lot of beans, you love cassoulet. You have to. We'll see that tomorrow. We'll tell you all about it tomorrow.
I'm looking forward to hearing that. I'm glad that I'm missing the smell that will come in the car from eating all of those beans. To be honest, I'm glad that I'm at the safety of being back here.
We've been missing you. I keep telling myself, Rose should have been on the road with us, but that's life. Next time.
I know. Next time, I'm coming out for the Tour de France Femme, which is very exciting. So I will get to have a little bit of the get to spend a little bit of the cycling podcast budget at some point instead of just watching other people enjoy these spectacular meals that you're having. But, well, we should talk about the racing, shouldn't we? And hear what happened, first of all, in the Tel of the Etape. Ahead of the riders on stage 14, almost 200 kilometres of relentlessly bumpy riding in the Massif Central, culminating in the Category 2 Monte Jalabert and a kilometre of downhill into the finish line. The attacks came thick and fast from the start, most notably Tadej Pogacar spotting that yellow jersey Jonas Vingegaard was drifting towards the back, put in an explosive attack with a mere 180 kilometres of racing to do. He was closed down by Francois' golden Swiss Army knife, otherwise known as Wout van Aert. The Slovenian wasn't deterred though, attacking again and again. By his third strike, he had whittled the pack down to just the strongest riders of the race. Missing the cut, three of Vingegaard's teammates and sprinter Caleb Ewan, clearly still suffering from yesterday's crash and already 5 minutes down within the first 20 kilometres of racing. There were numerous further attempts to escape from the likes of Chris Jensen and Nielsen Paulus, but UAE set an infernal pace in an effort to capitalise on Vingegaard's depleted team, but the yellow jersey himself would not be caught out. It was only on reaching the Côte de Châtenay that the break was finally formed for the day. attacks across the road from the likes of Marc Soler, Jakob Fuglsang and Thibaut Pinot, eventually grouping into a 23-man break. Among them, King of the Mountains Simon Geschke, perennial breakaway rider Luis Leon Sanchez, plus three riders each from Bora Hansgrohe, EF Education Easy Post and Israel Premier Tech, plus Louis Meintjes, who began the day just 15 minutes and 46 down on GC. With Jumbo-Visma content with that, the pace slowed, allowing Roglic back into the bunch. At 115 kilometres to go, the gap was 8 minutes 25, lifting Meintjes into the top 10 on GC. But things were less good for Ewan. Despite being shepherded by three teammates, he was 18 minutes behind already and still losing ground. With the riders in the break all trying to get the better of each other, it was at just over 50 kilometres to go that Michael Matthews snapped the elastic, gaining 20 seconds on a false flat. Another lone representative for his team, Lotto Soudal's Andreas Kron, ignited the counterattacks but couldn't get away himself until Felix Groschartner and Luis Leon Sanchez led the way. A quartet formed, leading by 30 seconds as they approached the Côte de la Fage. And as the furious attacks behind continued, the break stretched his advantage to 13 minutes and 30 seconds, which, if it finished that way, would catapult Meintjes into the top five on GC. On the penultimate climb, the teams with greater numbers in the break looked to bridge to the front of the race. Stefan Kung hoping to set up FDJ teammate Thibaut Pinot. And then a huge pull from Alberto Bettiol sent Ed Pickering's choice from yesterday, Bauke Mollema, backwards. EF's pressure continued when Rigoberto Urán took up the reins, but the gap remained 27 seconds as they crested the top. Lotto Soudal's terrible luck continued, a puncture for Kron taking him out of the front group. The now three-man escape ploughed on and reached the foot of the Monte Jalabert ahead by just 20 seconds and with a fearsome gradient to surmount. Michael Woods' hard work among the chasers thinned their numbers out, while just in front, Groschartner and Sanchez were beginning to be distanced by a determined Matthews. As they drift back into the hands of the pursuers, Bettiol put in a monster surge, rapidly eating into the Australian's lead and eventually joining him with 1.4 kilometres of the climb remaining. The Italian stayed in his wheel until there was a kilometre of uphill left. He burst away, but Matthews managed to keep him on a short leash, eventually lengthening to around 10 metres. Matthews continued to hold on and began to gain ground on Bettiol. With 400 metres to the summit, he jumped out of the saddle for the first time on the climb. Bettiol had nothing in response. All that was left was a sweeping downhill to the finish line for the team bike exchange rider, who began the celebrations in the final straight. Bettiol came in second, Pinot in third. The GC group hit the final climb themselves then, Sepp Kuss leading them onto it, but the moment he swung away, Team UAE kicked into action with Brandon McNulty and Rafał Majka looking to dislodge a now isolated Vingegaard. Pogacar made his move in explosive fashion, but Vingegaard holds strong. The same couldn't be said for the rest though, gaps opening to the Ineos pair of Geraint Thomas and Adam Yates, and then another gap to David Gaudu, Enric Mas, Romain Bardet and Nairo Quintana. Pogacar continued his steady assault, but Vingegaard proved unshakable, even on the sprint to the finish. Meintjes is the big winner of the day on GC, jumping up to seventh, but despite some time losses, the top six positions remain unchanged.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, title sponsors of the Cycling Podcast. You'll, of course, have heard by now that they have their own podcast too, the Super Sapiens podcast, and that's hosted by Zylon Van Eyck and Dr. David Lippmann. All week, we've been enjoying clips from a recent episode when they talked to SD Works rider Ashley Moolman-Passio. And here's another.
You know, Banyoles is a little bit more of like a local town. Girona is fantastic, But it has become, you know, very sort of metropolitan. It's not, it's very, you know, there's a lot of expats who have settled in Girona now. So you don't really necessarily always get the real flavor of living in Catalonia. So Banyoles is great because the other reason I love it so much is, you know, pro cycling is pretty intense. So when we're at the races or busy or with our team, you know, it's really intense. And so going back to Girona and just being confronted every day by all the pros, I kind of felt like, how do you ever escape? So, you know, Banyoles is also great because I feel like a normal person in Banyoles.
Find out more about Super Sapien's system of continuous glucose monitoring, which can help tailor your fueling and training for success. Go to supersapiens.com. Well, it was a spectacular win for Michael Matthews, wasn't it? After 2 second places so far this tour to get the win. We know we heard from Mitch, didn't we, earlier in the week, Francois, when you were here with doing the podcast with him, that he felt that maybe Michael Matthews was lost a bit of aggression, but that's not what it looked like today, did it?
He maybe missed a little bit, lost a little bit of aggression in the sprints, but obviously he gained a little bit of aggression in this kind of sharp, short climbs, and it was probably part of these of the reasons for his victory today, because everybody obviously in the break was fearing his sprinter ability. You know, if there had been a sprint, you know, obviously Matthews would have been the man to beat, and he actually kind of outwitted them, or you know, wrong footed them by attacking 53 k's from the finish line. And I've always been, you know, I'm not a great fan. I don't like to be over enthusiastic, but I've always been a great fan of Michael Matthews. I think he deserved he's had a tremendous career already, but I think he deserved more, you know, like a monument or even, you know, world championship. I think he was near, really close to that level, and to see him ride the way he rode today and win the victory the way he did it, you know, with giving his all and even tactically being really, sometimes back exchange are criticized for being a little bit too blunt in their tactics. Today, the way Matthews rode, and I mean, I asked a question to Matt White, we'll listen to him, but you know, I think it's probably one of Michael Matthews' greatest wins, to be honest.
I was incredibly impressed with how he raced. And, you know, it was a big group that went away, and he was the only rider from his team in a breakaway that had, you know, multiple riders from different teams. How he raced so aggressively, and you know, once he finally went away with four riders and was, you know, on paper maybe not the best climber in that group, but you know, he said in a post-race press conference that he has been working on his climbing a little bit more because the team does have Groenewegen here, who, you know, is more often than not going to be the faster sprinter on a flat stage. So knowing that there are some, you know, specific stages that he could target that might, you know, Groenewegen might not be there, and he needed to make sure he was ready for those stages to take those opportunities. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of talk about how unfortunate he's been to come into cycling at this era when, you know, you have Van der Poel, Van Aert, you know, these riders who are, you know, once in a generation riders who, you know, are consistently beating him on the stages that he would more often than not win if those riders weren't around. But the way he rode the whole stage, you know, attacking, you know, 50K to go, and that's, you know, for someone like him, you know, he's an incredibly strong rider, and he's been, you know, he's had leader, you know, the yellow jersey in Paris-Nice before, and he's, you know, he can put out a good time trial. So he's an incredibly strong rider, but to have that confidence and then to see the way he rode that final climb once Betty all caught up to him, you know, incredibly impressive. And that's really a sign of his age and experience, that he didn't panic. You know, he rode steady, and, you know, watching it, you know, he just kept him in sights, knowing that I just have to keep him within sight up to the top. And if I can make it within, you know, 5 or 10 seconds to the top, then I know I'm going to beat him in a sprint. And he really showed a lot of you know, class, character, and experience up that final climb. Cause it, you know, it's easy, especially a team that's, you know, and a rider that's been really searching for that stage win here, you know, to get a little bit overexcited and a little bit overambitious up that final climb.
Yeah, we said the other day with Mitch that he was a little bit too kind, you know, as a rider and as a person, to, you know, you have sometimes to be a killer. I think today Alberto Bettiol, who came second, didn't find Michael Matthews too kind to him, because he really, you know, really beat him. You know, you could feel the confidence, the trust he had himself, the will to you know, at last win that stage. It's his fourth Tour de France stage win, but he hadn't won since 2017. And it's like more than 1,800 days without winning a stage on the Tour de France. I like Jasper Stuyven as well. I was very happy when Jasper won Milan-San Remo, and they're the same type of riders, and they were the two riders who had the most top 10 finishes in World Tour races together. You know, they're the same type. They're so close to being up there with the greats, and there's just a little bit of aggression missing today. Well, the aggression was there, and I'm very happy for Michael Matthews.
And do you think a little bit that, you know, you mentioned, Boz, about how versatile he is as a rider. Do you think in a way that has counted against him in a way in the past? If people are kind of in a break with him, then they think he's so versatile that he could win from any position?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really with him, it's a blessing and a curse, because, you know, while he's one of the best riders in his, you know, in these various disciplines, you know, he's not quite at the level of a Van der Poel or, you know, a Van Aert. So and I think, you know, one thing that he may have to do going forward is maybe specialize in, you know, a specific type of stage. You know, I think, you know, prior to, you know, the past couple of years, he's kind of been able to, you know, go for the flat sprints and also go for the hilly sprints as well. Oftentimes he'd be going up against Sagan as well. But, you know, I think as he grows and kind of, you know, matures as a rider, you know, focusing on more specific stages, and, you know, knowing that, you know, the flat sprints are, you know, incredibly specific now, and maybe he doesn't need to contest those, but contest more stages like we had today. And, you know, I've been racing Matthew since 2010 when we first did Tour de l'Avenir together, and it was an incredibly hard, you know, addition that Quintana won. And I think he was oftentimes top 10 on the mountaintop finishes up in the Alps. You know, he's a rider who can climb. You know, he lives in Monaco, so he spends a lot of times in the hills riding. Like I said, it's great to see him win today. And, you know, in the post-race press conference, you could really just see how much it meant to him to finally be back on the top step of a Tour de France stage.
There was a nice little remark made by our, you know, car partner Ed Pickering, who was on the podcast yesterday, who said, you know, for a long time, Bling, as his nickname everybody knows, looks like a boy in a grown man's body, and today I think there was still a little bit of boyishness in himself in the playful way he played with the breakaway today, but there was definitely a grown man who it was definitely a grown man's victory today. It was really exciting, and you know, you can tell he's matured. Maybe his reputation, we discussed that with Mitch the other time, is not one of the favorite riders apparently for the other Aussie guys, because he's very, very close. He's a family man, very close to his wife. And sometimes he was seen a little bit as kind of a, you know, mammy's boy. And so he was a little bit derided for that. But it makes him even more, you know, I like him even more for that, you know, than... And being the solid guy, and I really think it means something that for Matthews, as you said, Ian, he might, you know, decide to go for these kind of stages in the future. And once again, I mean, you know, sometimes world championships look a bit like today's stage. Well, longer, of course, but I really think he should won the, like Stuyven, you know, won a monument. I think really Matthews should win one of the really big ones.
Yeah, and he mentioned a lot, you know, after the race of how much it meant for, you know, for him to win, but also for his family. And I think that's something that oftentimes, you know, maybe fans and, you know, people just watching the sport don't realize, that, you know, it really does take a family to be a successful cyclist, especially at this level of the Tour de France, you know, with altitude training camps becoming more common and time on the road, and, you know, just your life at home it's completely centered around you, the athlete, which is, you know, it takes an incredible partner to be there and to support you. And, you know, I know he does have a kid at home, and, you know, I have a young one as well. And I was like thinking today, I was like, oh my goodness, I could not imagine having a kid at the same time of trying to race in the World Tour, because you're so focused on yourself all the time, you know, and it takes a partner who's incredibly understanding of what you're doing. And, you know, that sometimes you want to go to sleep early, and, you know, the baby's crying, you need your rest, and how important that is. And, you know, for him to thank his wife, you know, it really does show that, you know, it takes, you know, his whole family's behind him, and, you know, it pays back the sacrifices that they've all made for him to be on the top step of today's stage.
Well, of course, his family was all behind him, but also his team Bike Exchange, were all behind him. And so should we hear now from Matt White, the DS from Team Bike Exchange, who you were speaking to, Francois, and then David McPartland, who's also DS at Team Bike Exchange.
Well, Matt, I've always been a great fan of Bling, I shouldn't say that, but today is probably one of his most sensational victories.
Hands down, any stage win at the Tour de France is a special one. but he's evolved over the years, and he could win in reduced group sprints, short uphill kicks, but no, that's a tough climb to the finish. What we tried to get across to Bling this morning is believe in yourself and be unpredictable. Now, in the past, people have always seen Michael as a fast guy that had to get rid of. You know, but that's on a flat stage, that's how you play that out. But today's not a flat stage. People wouldn't have expected Michael Matthews to attack 50k from the finish, would they? And he caught people napping.
We know he could climb, but we didn't know he could climb that well.
He was going very well in Tour of Switzerland. We knew that his condition was as good as it gets. He's already shown some great condition in the sprint so far. But yeah, that was a very, very impressive ride. He took the bull by the horns there, and I said it's definitely the most impressive win of his career.
2 second places, so close to victory. He never lost faith in himself.
No, and we never lost faith in him. No, we didn't have a day that we wanted yesterday, but you've got to move on quickly. We have. Today we had a focus to try to put Nick Schultz or Michael in the breakaway. And then the way Michael got there, and he got there the hard way. Go through how he did things today. One incredible ride to get across to the break. He had some help doing that from teammates. And then once he got in the break, he rode a really tactically astute final. And at the end of the day, you can ride as smart as you want, but if you haven't got the legs, you're not going to win it. And he had the legs and absolutely nailed it.
Any scare when Betjol went?
Oh, it was a little bit scary in the car, that's for sure. Because you have no control. You have no control over what's happening there. But Michael never gave up. And at the end of the day, the strongest man won.
We came into this Tour de France, we knew that we have Dylan Groenewegen for the sprints and we have Michael Matthews for the stages that finish on a slight uphill incline. That was a big uphill incline, obviously 3 kilometres at 10%. It was always going to be difficult from that group. There's a lot of good climbers, so had to anticipate. It was the only way we could win. And he did it. He did it from a fair way out. It was his legs that did it in the end. It was simple as that. Took a bit of encouragement, of course, but because it's always a risk, but he also understood that, you know, he had to anticipate, and he picked the moment. We gave him all the info of the course, what was coming up. There was some tricky parts of the course there. We had the opportunity. He started it. There's only a few guys that went with him, and I mean, it was a long time there where we didn't know whether it was going to go all the way to the finish, even on the last climb, halfway up the last climb. When Betjol came across to him, we just said, you know, stay, you have to stay with Betjol. If you've arrived with Betjol, you're going to win the stage. And then Betjol got about, I think, 5 or 6 seconds on him. And we reminded him again and again on the radio, if you can get back to him, you'll win the stage. And he turned it around and actually rode away from Betjol in the end. So he deserved everything he got. Got some more opportunities for sure. It's not going to be easy to control a stage like tomorrow. There's so many teams here that still haven't won a stage. We've seen every day here the Tour that it's aggressive. Everyone wants to get in the breakaway. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But if it's not tomorrow, we've still got another 2 sprint stages later in the week.
So that was Matt White and David McPartland, both of them DSs at Team Bike Exchange. I guess part of why the win was so spectacular for Michael Matthews was the people that he beat, wasn't it, Francois?
When we were in the car traveling to Mont from the start, we always do that in the morning. We do a kind of pronunciation saying, oh, who'd you see in the break today? And all the names we mentioned were there, you know. So it was the strongest possible breakaway. You had, of course, Michael Matthews, we had Alberto Betjol, who also was close to winning. I mean, was very...
There was Ed Pickering's choice, Bauke Mollema, who Ed Pickering picked yesterday.
He was there, yes.
He was there.
Well, Thibaut Pinot, we all expect him to do something one day. I mean, lots of these guys, Andreas Kroon, we can't name that. Well, you name most of them in the tail of the etap, but Benoît Cosnefroid, there are so many of these guys, Stephen Kung, I mean... To beat the bunch like this, you it's very difficult to pick the winner, you know. And I guess that's also, as we said in the beginning, the others, you know, was probably so scared of the final climb, and they were probably looking at Menkes and at the guy Pinot and the climbers, thinking we must get rid of those guys. But, you know, they didn't have the time to do that because Matthews was gone.
It's a trend we've really seen throughout this entire Tour de France is how hard and how exciting every stage has been. Today's stage started off with, you know, Tadej Pogacar in second place in the white jersey, you know, two-time winner of the Tour de France, attacking at the beginning of, you know, it was a hilly stage, but it wasn't a stage in the Alps, you know, and, you know, we were on our way to the finish line and I was, you know, following the race online. I was thinking, what the heck is going on? You know, and at one point, you know, it was Vingegaal, Wout van Aert, and Pogacar off the front with, you know, 175K to go. And I was thinking, this is insane. You know, what is Pogacar is going to pull them all to the, you know, the other two riders to the finish. And, you know, it's really a sign that racing has changed. You know, this isn't a style of racing that we've seen. You know, I spent years at Sky and, you know, we never had racing like this. You know, there were some exciting stages here and there, but really every stage has been exciting. And, you know, the feeling I got at the finish, just, you know, seeing riders and, you know, speaking to some people, is that this has been an incredibly hard tour, and every stage has been raced at 110%, which as fans is great. As a former rider, I just see these riders just coming across the finish line just completely shattered. And, you know, it's, I guess I see both sides of it. And, you know, traditionally there'd be hard days and then all of a sudden there'd be, you know, kind of an easy day because riders just need to rest and recover. But, you know, there's enough horsepower at the front of these races that they continually, you know, people are continually attacking and making the race hard regardless of the course.
Even in the break, I mean, as you said, the start was hectic because everybody was trying to get in the break, including Pogacar. But then even in the break, normally you've got like 23 guys riding together, and with guys of the caliber we mentioned, normally they take turns, you know, they pull hard, and when comes the finish, well, it's time for the big battle. Today was not the case at all. I mean, you know, the battle started from 60k from the finish line. You know, the break was scattered all over the place, guys attacking in turns, little groups. I must admit, in my 30 something tour, I've almost never seen you know, so much racing and excitement, and as I used the word playful before, but yeah, it's a playful tour, and it's nice, it's great to watch.
Yeah, I mean, in 2019, you know, we had a similar stage, actually Toumond, and, you know, it played out almost the same except for the excitement. You know, a breakaway went, they got a bunch of time, and then they raced it out at the front, and we, you know, raced, the GC riders raced at the back. But I mean, could you imagine in 2018 seeing Geraint Thomas attack at the start of a stage finishing in Mond? I mean, there's no way. And, you know, I guess I'm starting to try to, like, read into the psyche of Pogacar. You know, and my initial thought when he was attacking was, oh, no, maybe he's sick and maybe he's not feeling well and he's going to do a, you know, Vanderpool the other day was in the breakaway and then pulled out. And I thought maybe he's not feeling well. He's just trying to put on a show and he's gonna pull out of the stage. But clearly that's not the case. And then I was thinking, you know, the fact that Vingegaal actually followed him means that, you know, it makes no logical sense because you have so far to go. He's up the road by himself. You know, you have your full team left. You know, they're one of the few teams that, you know, they haven't lost a rider. Let him go up the road and burn his energy. But that Vingegaal is so, and I guess the whole Jumbo-Visma team is so worried about Pogacar that they're not going to let him go, that they have to follow him, which is almost irrational. You know, honest, it's not, you know, four big climbs over the Alps where it's, you know, just essentially climbing or descending. He's actually following him on a relatively, you know, on a stage when you can really use all of your teammates. And the fact that Vingegaal is, you know, chasing a move like that is a sign that, you know, maybe it's a little bit of inexperience. And it's also possible that, you know, Pogacar realizes that he can start to play these kind of mind games with Vingegaal.
Yeah, but it's also a great ingredient of this Tour de France. That's we have a big rivalry between two guys. I mean, they're always together. They seem to kind of enjoy the sort of duel they're staging. You know, like they were together, as you said, in a break at the start, but they were also together in the last climb. You know, to the La Montée Laurent Jalabert or the Côte de Mans. I mean, this climb has many names, but you know they were together, and they look like they're inseparable. You know, you well, when one is there, the other is not far. You know, they and it's exciting to have this kind of, you know, man to man fighting, and hopefully it'll go on for the last week and be even more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I think in modern history, and you know, since I've been following the sport, you know, I haven't really seen two riders in the Tour de France go head-to-head so evenly matched. You know, outside of the stage to Grenon, you know, we haven't seen two riders so close. And, you know, really just going with each other, you know, attack for attack, blow for blow, you know, not just in the beginning of the race, but, you know, in the end of the race as well. And I think, you know, maybe the last time would be, I don't know, Le Monde and Hinault, where they're literally, you know, they're...
It reminds me more of 1989, Le Monde and Fignon, you know, when they were attacking each other every day, and there was that similar kind of, you know, teasing each other, even at the start. I remember a stage to Saint-Etienne, actually, in that tour, in the same area, where really Fignon and Le Monde were attacking in turns. It's very similar, and remember how it ended, you know, the guy who was in the lead for a long time finally lost it, so all we can hope for is as much suspense, battle, and you know, and unpredictable finale. We'll see.
Why have we asked our contractor we found on Angie.com to be our kids' legal guardian? Because he took such good care when redoing our basement that we knew we could trust him to care for our kids, all 8 of them, should something happen to us.
Are you my dad now?
No, sorry, I do basements.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy, bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2 times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's Breakfast with Boz here on the Cycling Podcast. Possibly my best morning yet. I woke up at 6:30. I was fairly tired. I normally don't wake up to an alarm, but I did set an alarm because after my rest day yesterday, I knew I wanted to get out for a ride today, and I sure am glad that I did because it is an absolutely beautiful region in which we are staying up here in Le Bassette in the Massif Central. And I mapped out a little route, uploaded it to my Wahoo, and got out for an awesome 30-mile ride this morning. Probably the most beautiful ride I've done here in France so far. Of course, riding in the Alps is beautiful, but there is something special about the rural, quiet, and I don't want to say rolling hills because they're pretty big hills, but the climbs around here in the Massif Central. I did the Col de l'Oyon, I believe. It was actually a climb that Francois had not heard of, but it has been used 4 times in the Tour de France before, all won by Spanish-speaking riders, some Spanish and some Colombian riders, last in 1995. And I was super happy to get out and do a ride. I was worried that I wasn't going to make it back in time for breakfast. I left the hotel without eating breakfast or drinking a coffee. And being in rural France, it was hard to find anything that was open early on a Saturday morning. But I made it back in time for breakfast. And of the 4 or 5 mornings I've been here, it was the first time we've actually stayed in an actual hotel. So there was breakfast here at the hotel, and very typical French breakfast, which was actually kind of nice. I've been going out and having options of what sort of pastry I'm going to pick and what kind of quiche I'm going to get. And today was very simple. I had a croissant and I had some bread with butter and jam. I did have a piece of cheese that the lady brought out to throw on my bread, but very simple and kind of nice just to have a simple, easy morning, a gorgeous bike ride. And corrections corner, we did figure out this vegetable that I found in this roundabout up in L'Alpe d'Huez yesterday. It is called cardone, or maybe Italian would be cardone or cardoon. I'm not entirely sure of the pronunciation, but I found it on the internet after we recorded last night, and a listener also reached out to share what it was. I don't know where to find it. I've never seen it in the U.S., but if I have the opportunity to go to a garden store, maybe I'll see if I can find some seeds and try to bring it back to the U.S. and plant it. I'm not sure how well it would grow up in northern New England with the cold winters, but something to try. We do have a greenhouse. So I'm going to get dressed. We are about to head off down to Le Monde, and we're going to drop down off the hills here in the Massif Central and drop in to the heat ahead of stage 14 of this year's Tour de France.
Well, that was today's Breakfast with Boz, and it was good to find out that it was a cardone. Did you work out how to say it?
Yeah, I think I saw someone in Italian, is it Cardi? I don't know the proper pronunciation, and you know, we discovered last night at dinner that, you know, Francois had never seen it. It is a very rare vegetable.
I should say that is a big thing on the Cycling Podcast, to find something that Francois doesn't know. That's quite incredible. That's a landmark moment for us, I think.
It's a new segment, Stump the Chump.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll go into Cardone or wherever it's. Yeah, Cardone, I think, big time now, you know. So next time I'll tell you all about it. But no, it's really, I've never heard of it.
Yeah, you said it was popular in France and popular in Italy. And we should move on to another Italian favourite that you found, Francois, on the race today. So please listen in, dear listeners.
Giro, could you explain to us how has Alberto Bettiol been racing in this Tour de France?
As you already know, dear listener, normally I'm more involved, not really
in cycling tactics, maybe I'm more prepared in beaches or holidays, but specifically speaking about Alberto, I think that he had in the past very difficult moments, a lot of physical problems. Normally he's known in Italy as the man so far that he had great days, as for example the Flanders or the stage victory in the Giro, but he's not able to give a kind of standard of high results. So he's trying to do his best to make a personal result, and so sometimes maybe he can sometimes he can also make mistakes, as all human being, no?
So today you made a big mistake.
In my opinion, maybe a first mistake, maybe could have been better for him to stay with the four guys when the Matthews, the action with the Gross Schacht and Luis Leon Sanchez. And then in the climb named for Jalabert, it would have been better to stay with Matthews and not try to make a gap with him immediately. But also we have also to consider that he lost by Matthews, that been really, really, really strong.
So the chance of an Italian victory before Paris?
The time trial with Filippo Ganna on Saturday certainly can be a chance. I don't see an Italian winning in the mountain stage of Pyrenees, Peyragudes and Otacam. But in the other days, for example, I never expecting Alberto second in a finish like this, because I thought that the finish climb was too hard for him. So who knows, dear listeners? But remember that the most important stages of this tour is the stage of Monday 25th, the stage number 22, the only stage that I can win.
Well, you know, it's not very difficult to find Ciro on the Tour de France. He's already chasing the Italian, or the Italians doing well, and the man is kind of chasing after since the start of this Tour de France has been Alberto Bettiol. It's fun. Dear listeners, you should see Ciro at the buses or at near the team cars. He's as you can imagine, very nervous and very fidgety, running around trying to get to the rider first. As you heard, I like it with Ciro. He's always optimistic that an Italian might finally win a stage. Bettiol obviously was one of the closest to do that in his Tour de France. Unfortunately. We saw in the pavé, on the Roubaix stage, what we call the Roubaix stage, that his attitude, the way he rode, was not simple to understand. Today he really rode much more cleverly, than he did probably in Roubaix. And he's been there all the time. You can tell, he's in great shape, he's in great form, he's not far from it. He's a little bit in the same position as Matthews was before today. So. Who knows? Yeah, he might finally get it.
EF was one of the teams with three riders in the breakaway, and I was seeing their tactics. I was a little bit confused as to what they were doing, because at one point the four riders had gone up the road with Matthews, and Bettiol went to the front and started riding. And I was thinking, okay, well that makes sense, because they have Rigo in the group, and if they can close that gap before the final climb, then surely if Rigo's on a good day, it's a great climb for him. Lo and behold, Bettiol took a big pull. They didn't really take any time out of the breakaway, and he actually almost at one point got dropped. He was kind of just made it onto the tail end of the chasing group over the top of the climb, and was able to get back into the line, and turns out that he had a much better day and much better legs than Rigo. And so I caught up with Charlie Wagelius after the stage to kind of ask him about that, because I was completely puzzled as to why would you put Bettiol on the front to close the gap if he was your strongest rider. But 14 days into the tour, there's a lot of unpredictable feelings, and so let's hear from Charlie Wagelius about their team tactics and what he'd heard from Bettiol before the final climb.
You guys have been racing aggressive whole tour. How do you feel about today's stage?
I think the whole tour's been racing aggressive, to be honest. That start was something for the record books. We knew that this was one of the last stages in the race where you can really go for the win from a long breakaway, because of the Pyrenees, they're going to be super hard. So I think to get those three in there was already a great effort. Managing a break like that isn't easy. When the group with Matthews went, we knew that we were a little bit on the back foot, and we had to try to correct that on the penultimate climb. In that moment, Alberto said he didn't feel great, So when he went to pull, that was to try and close the gap, but I don't think he realized how well he was going. I think we saved the race there, but in hindsight, we'd obviously preferred to do it with another rider. But asking, everybody feels so tired in those moments, it's really hard for everybody to judge how they're feeling. And I think Alberto did everything he could to get rid of Matthews on that final climb, but you could see he was just so strong that he resisted that attack. And I think that coming to the line with Michael Matthews in a two-man sprint wasn't really an option that we wanted to take.
I mean, Bettiol's, you know, shown that he's clearly in decent form and coming back to his best. I mean, it's so hard on a day like today when it's also so hot and long, and you do have three riders in the break, so other teams are looking at you to control. I mean, you've been a rider before. I mean, as a director, how do you try to manage who's feeling the best in that situation? Because obviously we saw Bettiol put in a big dig to try to close the gap, but it wasn't really coming down, and at the end he was the best rider on the team.
Yeah, I mean, we asked him at the bottom of that climb, and he said over the radio that he didn't feel good. He was having a bit of a bad moment, but I think he just didn't realize how strong he was actually in that moment, because everybody in the race was cooked. Everybody had done more or less the same effort to make it in the break. You saw the quality of the riders, the heat and everything. So I think maybe in that moment he just lacked a little bit of faith in himself, or just didn't realize how good he was feeling. Nonetheless, everybody did the best that they could, and if second's the best we can come away with today, then so be it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great ride by Bettiol, and also good to see him back in contending stages.
He's had quite a few health problems over the last period, but he's a winner, you know. I don't think he's so happy with second today.
Bettiol actually, you know, when he came to the bus, there was a bunch of us journalists, you know, waiting for him. He sat on the, on the little steps going up into the bus, looking really tired and frustrated, but in the same time, you know, very honest about the about his day, you know, up front. And well, let's listen to Alberto.
I was feeling not super, but in the end it was better than the beginning. I spent quite a lot for getting to the breakaway. Sometimes you spend 5 hours on the bike, and then in a few seconds your victory go. I think Matthews deserve this victory, but I promise everybody, especially in this team, that all the staff of this team that make a big effort for us to try for another victory. And I'm disappointed for me, for them, for people that believe me, but Tour de France is not over yet, and I will give another try.
It seemed as though you had almost cracked Matthews. Could you feel that he was really on the limit?
He did exactly like what I did a few days ago, and he made it. And on the uphill finish a few days ago, I didn't make it to the finish. He started 52k to the finish. I bridged him 1k to the finish, and I didn't think personally he would have the legs to drop me, but I listened at the radio, my sport director saying try to drop him. More or less as I did last year in Giro d'Italia with Cavagna, but unfortunately I found a really strong Matthews. He deserved to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a sense of disappointment with Alberto for, you know, being so close to winning the stage but then not winning the stage. But I think in many regards, you know, it's also a sign and probably a huge confidence booster. You know, he has had a hard couple of years, and to finally find himself once again at the front of a race, and you know, he, you know, doing the work he did for the team, you know, trying to close that gap, you know, 50-60k to go. And then still being the rider that, you know, came closest to matching Matthews up to Mond, you know, it was a really impressive ride. And I think, you know, although he is disappointed, it probably is a real, you know, confidence booster to know that he is getting back to his best. And, you know, he is a rider who can, you know, win stages in the biggest races.
I was wondering whether since, you know, his Cobbles incident, when, you know, everybody said, well, he'd ridden for himself instead of the team, if he's not paying that back in a way by, you know, he worked for Magnus Cort in Megève, he worked for Rigo today, and maybe, you know, maybe he's trying to prove a little bit too much that is a team, you know, it's really as a team spirit and works for the team. And maybe it cost him, you know, a little bit of energy today. We'll never know, but hopefully if we follow Ciro's advice and you know, optimism, he might get one.
Yeah, I mean, he was not the only person to kind of miss out at the last, was he? I mean, we had Louis Menkes on the road. He was 15 minutes 46 seconds down on GC when the stage began. And definitely when I was watching the coverage from here, the commentators were constantly saying, you know, if the race finished here, then Louis Menkes, being in the break, he would be throwing himself into the top 10, to the top five. At one point, he made it even that he would be the yellow jersey. So, you know, what do we make of Louis Menkes? Is he actually a GC contender going ahead, or is this kind of a lucky break? Well, literally a lucky break.
We saw he was excellent in the Alps. I think he's in the form of his life. I mean, he was eighth in the Tour twice. I mean, he had top 10 Grand Tour finishes, but he's now seventh. I think it's his best Grand Tour placing, standing, you know, in his career. It's also a sign of the way, as Ian was saying, that the cycling's changed. Back in the day, you know, as we say, they wouldn't have let a guy who was in 13th place with even 15 minutes adrift go in the break, you know. And so they're ready to take those chances now. And I mean, so in a way, yeah, Menkes took really advantage of the situation. And I mean, yeah, he's in. I think if he keeps the same kind of shape in the Pyrenees, is a top 10, you know, finisher for sure, maybe a little bit better than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think he also made a very conscious decision today that he was here to ride GC, and that because the racing is so unpredictable now that, you know, he could continue to kind of climb the GC ladder. You know, he is sitting second overall in the KOM classification, and he was never really motivated by that classification today. You know, there was opportunities that he maybe could have chased those points a little bit more. However, he made it clear that, hey, we have a huge gap. We could continue to gain time, and I can climb this GC ladder. And if, you know, clearly he's feeling well enough that he knows that he could hopefully, you know, in the Pyrenees continue to stay up there, or maybe even climb higher. And so, you know, smart riding by him as well to realize the situation that he's in, and that, you know, he is a rider that maybe is a little bit off the radar of the big GC teams. So they might let him slip up the road and might not necessarily, you know, look at him as a rider who can contend for the overall. But this is kind of the point in the race as well, when teams start defending different objectives and different strategies, and you know, teams do start racing for, okay, let's try to secure fifth place or sixth place. So I think in the next week we'll see more of that happening.
Anyway, yeah, I had a chance to grab, you know, Louis Menkes, not the most outspoken rider in the bunch, but you know, there were three of us there, and this is what he had to say.
Yeah, I always think about it, but yeah, I'm also realistic. Yeah, I knew I would have to have a lot more time to be able to keep it to the finish, but I thought, yeah, maybe for a few seconds I was the virtual leader, but yeah, by the end of the stage I was pretty sure it wouldn't be the case. Still very far to go and a lot of things still to happen, so I'll dream about it a bit later.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsors, Science in Sport. Of course, we heard in our recent Kilometre Zero episode about the efforts that our producers Adam and Hugh put out to complete the ETAP this year. And if you're looking ahead to a challenge of your own, then head to scienceinsport.com for all your nutritional needs, whether that be for energy, hydration or recovery. And don't forget, you get 25% off all of their products when you head to scienceinsport.com and use the code SISCP25. Now, I can see already that I'm keeping you from your meal for tonight, but I did want to hear about yesterday's meal because frog legs were on the menu. I wondered how many people went for it in the end.
Well, there were three of us, Ian, Ed Pickering and myself. I could see that Ed was a little bit reluctant to go with the frog legs, but I mean, Ian is, you know, he's adventurous, you know. He came on this Tour de France kind of to discover, well, he knows that the journalist's job better and better, and, you know, I mean, he's an impressive, you know, rookie in that field. But, and so, yeah, we went for the cuisse de grenouille, for the frog legs. And, well, what did you think, Ian?
They were delicious. I mean, I really love food and I love trying new things. And I think, you know, oftentimes when you're racing in the Tour de France, you have a team chef, so you never get to really taste the local culture and, you know, the terroir. And that's been the beauty of, you know, traveling around with Francois, is that, you know, he knows so much about the food. And, you know, I can ask him, like, hey, you know, what's the most traditional dish of this region, or what, you know, what wine are we going to drink? You know, even today driving through Le Puy, you know, explaining the, you know, the the statue and, you know, the castles and, you know, just general geography and, you know, architecture, you know, it's really been a, you know, a trip of a lifetime for me just to see, you know, a country I lived in, France, for so long. I spent a lot of time in Nice, but I really didn't get to know or learn much about the rest of the country because you're always in a team bus focused on the race and, you know, what the coming days. And so here I've actually been able to really embrace, you know, everything that Francois has been able to share.
It goes vice versa, because we found, you know, with Ian today that we are both fans of a country folk singer called Townes Van Zandt, who is a cult hero of mine and, you know, obviously also a hero of Ian. And so we drove across the Massif Central listening to Townes Van Zandt, who's, you know, a Texan. But yeah, it was nice to see that, you know, we share many, many passions in common and Townes Van Zandt and this kind of music was one of them. So, you know, we learn from each other, and that's the magic of the tour, I guess. about the region now where we are, it's actually a wine region more and more. You know, it was not too famous for wine. I mean, we've been, last night, the Frog's Legs, we were in the near Saint-Étienne in a region called Le Forez. We were actually at the top of La Croix de Chaubouret, I said last night, which is a famous pass in cycling history. And we went through all this territory. When we were near Le Puy-en-Velay, it's not far from where Romain Bardet lives. I mean, it's actually the Massif Central, a huge area with lots to see. When we were driving, we were seeing all those bumps. It's not like the Alps or the Pyrenees, much more bumpy, but it's also you know, all volcanoes. So I mean, this, you know, it's rather exciting. And the reflection we made, the thought we had, there was a suggestion a couple of years ago from, I don't know if it was ever made public, but I discussioned with Christian Prudhomme. He had that idea. I don't know if he will dare do it one day, to have a Tour de France without the really big mountains, to go for the most, you know, like, he's already a great fan of the Vosges, as we know now that, you know, La Planche des Belles Filles is there almost every year. He's a great fan of Massif Central as well. And they were thinking at the time, if we had a mid-mountain Tour de France, you know, maybe the guys like Michael Matthews, even Wout van Aert, or, you know, in his, you know, better days, Peter Sagan could go for the Tour de France. I mean, probably the result would be the same, finally. But it would be interesting, from time to time, to have the Tour de France without, I'm not saying without the Alps or the Pyrenees completely, but, you know, with more stages like Megève or more stages like today, and maybe for more of an all-rounder within the Tour than just a climber.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent very little time in the Massif Central outside of racing, and, you know, especially being an American and being a cycling fan, you know, oftentimes you hear people, oh, they're taking a trip to the Alps or the Pyrenees. But if I was a cycling fan, I would come here because there are so many roads. They're incredibly quiet. You know, it's definitely not catered towards, you know, tourism. You know, there's no menus in English. You know, everyone speaks French. But as, you know, someone who speaks very, you know, little French, I really enjoy it because it really feels like you're in France. And there is so much, you know, unique culture in each and every place. And it's not, you know, blown up. It's incredibly quiet. You know, the ride this morning, I saw almost no cars. You know, I did three, I guess, pretty big climbs. And, you know, we've kind of been discussing this idea of a mid-mountain tour for a couple of days in the car and thinking this would be such exciting racing. You know, it would really open up the racing for allowing more people to be, you know, in contention to win the Grand Tours, which in my mind as a fan would be incredibly fun to watch.
Who would be your pick, Ian, for winning that mid-mountains Tour de France, would you say?
I mean, it's hard to discount Wout van Aert, but at the same time, you know, it would make the racing really dynamic. You would have stages that would be hard enough where maybe some climbers would take some time, but it would be 10 or 15 seconds, not minutes. And equally, you would have, you know, riders, you know, constantly being within, you know, even 2 or 3 minutes of taking the yellow jersey. So you would constantly, you know, eyes would always be on the breakaway. They wouldn't let breakaways get 10 or 15 minutes because there would be, you know, 40 or 50 riders within striking distance. And, you know, it would make it incredibly stressful for the riders because breakaways would never go. And, you know, it could even potentially dull the racing a little bit if, you know, we didn't see, you know, attacks going early. But at the same time, I think it's worth a try. You know, as the attention span of viewers becomes shorter, you know, I think there'll come a point in time when, you know, the Tour de France and the ASO do need to kind of consider, you know, what is the next evolution of this race.
In the same time, what's exciting about cycling also these days is that even climbers are much more all-rounders, versatile than they used to be. You know, we saw Nairo Quintana more than once, you know, doing well on the pavés, attacking, remember, what was it in the Vuelta? He broke away on his own. I mean, you know, the specialists, there are still specialists, of course, but I think all the riders are much more, you know, all-rounders, much more, you know, complete these days. And so I think that, you know, if you had the mid-mountain Tour de France, I would probably put my money on Tadej Pogacar anyway. So,
well, with that in mind, you know, the kind of the fact that people aren't kind of specialising as much, or, you know, all the riders seem to be able to do so many things. Casting ahead to tomorrow, that on paper should be a sprint stage, although I think I've said that a few times already, and it never has been. So what can we expect from tomorrow, Francois?
Well, the last winner in Carcassonne Tour de France was Magnus Cort. So, I'm not saying that Magnus can't sprint, because he's pretty fast. But oddly enough, it's a town, Carcassonne, that has suited sprinters in the past, but also from time to time, you know, breakaways. I guess that with the fatigue, and as we said, you know, it's been a very hard tour, very fast tour, and these roads in the sun, they're not very always very bumpy. You know, there are bumps, there are little hills, but they're very narrow, they're very winding, and so it's difficult really for a bunch to ride in those little roads in the sun. So a break is still possible, even though I think, you know, that the sprinter teams have missed opportunities a little bit too much for their own good. So I my impression is that they will probably try, because otherwise it's Paris, you know, it's, they don't have many more chances. So I guess tomorrow we can probably still think, you know, that they're going to really, really try to have a bunch sprint.
Yeah, I saw Caleb Ewan once again rolled in within time cut, and, you know, with his teammates and his teammates around him, I assume in anticipation that, you know, tomorrow is a day that they could win. But at the same time, you know, it's a long stage tomorrow. It's 202 kilometers, which, you know, for any team at this point in the race to control that is, and, you know, if we see a strong breakaway go up the road again like we saw yesterday, you know, it's really hard for even a couple of teams to try to control a breakaway of that size. So I think it really just depends on, can the sprinters teams in the beginning of the race make sure that the right breakaway goes up the road. But as we've seen recently in cycling, you know, there are no weak riders anymore. You know, a breakaway of five or six guys get 2 minutes and they might still stay away, which is something that is relatively new to the Tour de France. You know, typically you'd get 8 or 9 minutes and, you know, the breakaway would still come back, but that's not the case anymore.
And what do we know of Caleb Ewan's condition? Because obviously his crash yesterday kind of changed the narrative of what that stage was, because they didn't have Lotto Soudal chasing the breakaway then. What do we know of how he's feeling? I mean, he lost, he was down 20 minutes within a few tens of kilometres on this stage today. Do we know how he's feeling, or whether he'll be competitive tomorrow?
From what we gathered from the team, the word from John Lelong when he spoke to me yesterday was that, you know, they would make sure he recuperates and he recovers as much as possible. So there may be, you know, sprinters do that. Cavendish done it last year. When you have a time cut and you want to relax as a sprinter, the thing, if you ride well, the thing to do is to get to the finish as close as possible from a time cut, because, you know, you save, you know, as much energy as you can. It's quite possible that Caleb is not really trying hard, just, you know, saving energy, trying to recuperate and just making the time cut, and hoping that, you know, his condition will get better. What Lelong told me also yesterday, you heard it, if you listened to yesterday's episode, was that he was actually in great shape. You know, he'd recovered from his previous crash, was, you know, really going for it, and we'll see. Tomorrow might be the day, but I mean, if you take the dynamics of the other teams will be in there for a bunch sprint, and bike exchange, they won two stages now. They were already thinking about tomorrow's stage and think with Dylan Groenewegen in mind. So I think some teams have a real interest in tomorrow's stage being a bunch sprint. And Quickstep, you know, they started well, very well, and we haven't seen them since. So there are many. I think there are many teams. Many sprinter teams have an interest in tomorrow's stage being a bunch sprint.
So we'll have a bit of a first week resurgence from some teams, and like this team, because this is the last night that I'm covering the podcast with you two, covering for Lionel, of course, who's going to be flying in as we speak, and will be there in place, in his rightful place, back on chairing the podcast tomorrow, which we're all looking forward to.
It was a great pleasure, Rose. I mean, and I'm really sorry that you won't be with us for a cassoulet tomorrow, but I mean, there you are.
I know, it's a shame. Actually, no one ever asked me. I do have a drink every night. No one ever asked me what I'm drinking, yes, which is probably lucky.
Where are you, Rose?
I'm actually down in, I'm in beautiful Somerset by the sea. So I do have a lovely view. I've got a lovely glass of red here, actually, which I should take the opportunity to mention. It's part of the Cru de Flaneur collection of wine, which is curated by Greg Andrews at Divine Cellars. And that's still available if you want to drink along. I think it's a red from the Côte du Rhône, but I haven't got the bottle with me, so
well, I have a question for Divine Cellars, because I have been listening to the podcast often, and do they ship to the US? So that's a question that maybe they can get back to us about, because I know that
only they can answer that.
Yes, well, question to them: can they ship me a case to the US?
Or if they're really quick, they can just ship it to France. You can take it home with you. Although it might be expensive on the old extra luggage, I guess.
I can leave my bike here.
Yeah, what a good swap. But yeah, they've got a collection that is mirroring the tour this year. And so you can drink along with the tour. That would be, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Drinking, like almost like a tour drinking game. Well, thank you very much for your company this week, gentlemen. And I'm sure you'll be you'll be looking forward to normal service resuming. But thank you very much, Ian. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thank you, Rose. It's been great to connect and to have you here guiding us every day throughout this tour for me so far. And I hope we get to do it again soon.
Yes. And Francois, I mean, this is your difficult middle week, isn't it? You've still got another week to go.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, I'm, you know, maybe with experience like Michael Matthews, I'm improving, and I'm becoming a third week man more and more. I feel less tired with each day. So, you know, beware.
Well, that sounds like you're not giving up anytime soon. Normally, you're always saying this is your last one, your final flourish.
Oh yeah, no. It is almost definitely my last one. But I want to enjoy the third week. I mean, and you know, and once again, thanks very much, Rose, for taking us through that second week. It was a real pleasure to have you.
Well, almost definitely gives us some hope, Francois, that you'll be back next year. We always have hope for that you can be persuaded. But playing us out tonight is, of course, our Tour de Buffalo. And this time it's from the 2015 Tour, which obviously finished in a stage that finished in Mond as well. The day when Steve Cummings beat Bardet and Pino at the finish. We spoke about it yesterday, what a thrilling finish that was. But here's Richard Moore to tell us a little bit about Steve Cummings and a little bit about that stage.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
I think as well that he is prone to his head going down a bit. He can become a little bit negative. There was this famous story in 2010 where it was all going wrong for Team Sky, but they were being encouraged, told to attack every day, and it just nothing was happening for them. And you had two contrasting characters in the very upbeat, sunny, permanently aggressive Juan Antonio Fletcher and Steve Cummings, who by the third week really had given up. And there's a story of him going to the loo in the Team Sky bus and coming back and finding a post-it note on his chair from Juan Antonio Fletcher, which read, "You will leave your balls on the mountain or you will not get back on this bus." So anyway, let's hear.
I think the significance of the day as well for MTN Quebec, it's Mandela Day. They had an inspirational kind of team talk this morning. It was important to them on so many levels. And I think as one of the wildcard teams, you know, they'd already justified their presence in the race with Daniel Tecklaheimer not in the King of the Mountain jersey for so long. But I mean, this really is the icing sugar on the cherry on the cake.
Let's hear from Steve Cummings and then from Brian Smith, his general manager at MTN Quebec. Steve, can you just tell us how you rode the climb? There were a lot of attacks, guys going off. Did you know the way you were going to ride that climb? Because it's a very steep, very tough climb. What was your sort of strategy going up there?
Yeah, I knew I did the climb before in Paris-Nice in, I think, 2010. And
I knew it was really quite tough. I knew roughly it was around 10 minutes probably.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. When you use Angie for your home projects, you know all your jobs will be done well. Roof repair? Done well. Kitchen sink install? Done well. Deck upgrades? Done well. Electrical upgrade? Done well. Angie's been connecting homeowners with skilled pros for nearly 30 years, so we know the difference between done and done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk. Your PM wants feature adoption by cohort, and your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
Over time, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2 times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.